All right, we can go ahead and kick things off, I guess. Well, fingers crossed this all works. So welcome to our quarterly call for the Unitarian Universalist Common Endowment Fund and updates from the Investment Committee and Socially Responsible Investment Committee. I'm Andrew McGeorge. I'm going to attempt to mute everyone and see how that goes. So yeah, I appreciate you being guinea pigs with us today on the transition to the Zoom platform. For those of you that have called in the past, you know that the prior conference call system that we had was a little bit clumsy, and it was very difficult to keep everybody muted all the time, just because of when people joined the call or whatnot. So it was difficult. We're going to try it again today on Zoom and see how things go. So bear with us. If you notice on your screen that you have become unmuted for any reason, typically on a Zoom window on your computer, you'll see it in the bottom left, the ability to mute yourself. But I'll also keep an eye out for who is muted and unmuted. So I'm joined today by Kathleen Gaffney, who's the chair of our investment committee, and Kathy Mulvey, the chair of our socially responsible investment committee. And they'll really have the bulk of today's presentation for us. Our agenda today is pretty much the same as usual, to review the status of the Common Endowment Fund portfolio as of March 31st. As Kathleen will talk about, that happened to be a particularly unfavorable date for valuations across a lot of our investments. So we'll also give an update of where we were on April 30th. We'll talk about some of the highlights that we had on our virtual investment committee and SRIC meeting that we held on May 19th and some of the decisions that we made. And then we'll wrap things up by talking about where the investment committee and socially responsible investment committees will be present at our upcoming virtual GA. And the punchline is we're going to be all over the place, but we'll give you the exact details on all that. So that's good enough to kick things off. I'll turn it over to Kathleen to get started with the performance update. And I think in all my muting and unmuting, Kathleen, that you are currently muted, so you'll need to take yourself off mute to get going. And of course, just we'll be back at the end for any questions and answers. So thanks.
Great, thank you, Andrew, and it's great to be here and for the first time be able to see so many of you. I've been really looking forward to this call, to be able to put some faces to the names of our regular callers, so welcome and thank you for being here again. We're gonna start off looking at performance with slide 3, and as Andrew mentioned, it was a bumpy start to the year, particularly in February and most of March, with March bottoming, the market bottoming in March, late March, or on March 23rd. So what you'll see here are the fund returns versus our peers, and our peers are all other endowments in this universe, with a size of 50 to 250 million. So these are not all ESG managed portfolios, they're just endowments of a similar size to the UU Common Endowment Fund. And this is as of March 31st, so the first quarter of 2020, and our last meeting was on February, May 19th. And so those are the numbers that we reviewed. What you'll see here, if you look on the left-hand side, this is the first quarter's return. And it does capture the decline from February. Yet it also captures some of the rebound that we saw in the last week of March. And what you'll notice is that the UU Common Endowment Fund returned negative 14.3%, which is exactly the median, so right smack in the middle, of our peers. And keep in mind, this is a measure that we look at in the short term. It's nice to know where we are, but what's more important, as you know from all our calls, is that we focus primarily at the right-hand side of this table. So we're looking at the longer term returns, because markets will continue to go up and down. It's more important to stay steady with your asset allocation, and that is what will drive your long-term returns. And looking at those numbers, you'll see that from 3 years out, the fund has been able to outperform by at least median or above, frequently significantly above, and that has led to our very positive long-term returns. So for 15 years, you'll see that that number for the fund is 5.6%, which puts us in very good standing relative to our peers. But for a more detailed look, let's look at slide 4. And what you'll see here is that there was quite a return pickup coming from March to April. So the best way to focus on that is to look in this middle column, which is our fiscal year to date. So back in March, that number was negative 9.6. And just 1 month later, that number came back to down negative 3.6. So volatile markets indeed, but very little activity took place in the fund itself in terms of repositioning. So it really does reflect the benefit of sticking with a steady state in terms of your asset allocation. What is also interesting in digging into the details in April is that what you see, keeping a focus on fiscal year to date, is that we had, I would say, the tail of two very different markets in terms of what was going on with the equity market. The domestic equity composite, those are our US equity managers, were down 5%. The Russell 1000, which is this line here, measures our large cap equity managers. That index was down 0.1%. So basically flat for the fiscal year to date. But what's very interesting is how different types of stocks performed, with the value index down 11.3% and the growth index up 10.7%. So very much a tale of two worlds. And what's important is noticing the balance in our allocation, that we're diversified. We don't know whether value or growth is going to outperform, but right now the market is paying up for growth managers. It's also important to know that Rumline is our index manager and Sands is one of our active managers. So another important point about what you're seeing in the April numbers is that our active managers were truly helping us deliver those long-term returns. On the small cap equity side, which you'll see at the bottom of the page, those stocks took a bigger hit because they're smaller companies and tend to have less cash on the balance sheets, and the market was worried about what would happen with the economy. But going through that, the managers were successful in delivering close to market returns, if not better. And particularly on the international equity side, which is an area where we have a higher allocation than our average peer, but you can see even those markets were down in double digits, looking at the MSCI EAFE index down 12.1%. our managers were able to outperform by 400 basis points. So again, my point here is it's the broad diversification, confidence in our active managers, and staying focused on our asset allocation plan and not focusing on the short-term numbers. Fixed income, which has been, and I think we all think of as the ballast in portfolios, did fare better than the equity markets over this time frame. And I'm, again, focusing on fiscal year to date right here. Our portfolio was up a positive 2%, which did lag the broad market. However, keep in mind that the role of fixed income is to be defensive and provide ballast or less correlation to what's going on in the equity markets. And our fixed income exposure is divided between really two important segments: high quality fixed income, which is where our investment grade corporates and long treasury positions and our short duration high quality fixed income reside. And then the flexible fixed income, which allows us to take advantage of what is expected to be longer term, higher expected returns than high quality fixed income. High quality fixed income is expected to return to roughly 2% over the next 10 years, whereas flexible fixed income, because you are taking more risk in terms of credit and global sovereign, should add to returns over time. But what you'll see is that in terms of that fixed income exposure, the high quality was the driver of returns, particularly coming from long treasuries. And the flexible fixed income managers did not provide as much return, although certainly better than equities. And this is an area that we will be reviewing at our upcoming August meeting to make sure we are on top of how these managers are adjusting their portfolios in light of the current market. But you see a story here again of diversification and each manager having their roles and responsibilities. Slide 7 is a recap of private markets. There's not a lot of information to gain here because this is an asset class that is very long-term in nature, and it's a relatively modest part of the portfolio, currently at just over 5%. What we have done, which I think will be important for folks to look at, is that we've divided our private market opportunities into two categories. In a similar way that we do with our fixed income exposure, we have impact funds. So those are funds that are more closely aligned with our mission and our UU principles, and then non-impact funds, which are more traditional. So that's, I think, something that you'll want to take a look at in the quarters ahead, but not an important driver of current performance. We talked about the performance for fiscal year to date and the short and long term. And so at this point, I can get you to focus on slide 9. And this is what we did at the May meeting. Asset allocation and rebalancing plan was a focus for the investment committee. So I'm going to give you the highlights from the investment committee, and then we'll turn it over to Kathy Mulvey. Keep in mind that as we have talked about in previous calls, the meeting does happen now on one day. And for much of the meeting, it's a joint meeting with all members from the investment committee and the socially responsible investment committee attending together. And then shorter time periods where there may be specific focus that each committee will allocate for themselves. But the asset allocation and rebalancing is important to, I think, all of us. And NEPC, every May, does review their 10-year forward-looking capital market assumptions. And what was interesting is we were able to take a look at where they were as of the end of December 31, but also how the market had changed in the first quarter, so March 31. And with the market volatility, while in the short term we're looking at a decline in terms of returns, what it does mean is it creates opportunities for the future, that as market returns increase, it allows us to shift parts of the portfolio in order to capitalize on the changing markets and the increased return assumptions. And what we saw is fixed income worked exceptionally well, as we saw with those long treasury numbers. And so our focus has been on, going forward, trimming fixed income because it has performed so well, and shifting it just slightly into equity, where we're seeing more returns come about. We were fortunate, as we looked at the returns at the end of March, in being prepared for the volatility, because we've made some allocations at the February meeting to go into an all-cap impact-oriented equity manager, which was funded May 1st. And we decided, because of the volatility, we would do that in two segments. So the first one went on May 1st, and we reserved the other contribution for later this year, dependent on when we see better market opportunities. So asset allocation is my theme today, and we are looking to rebalance by just very marginal amounts to get us more in line with our long-term policy targets. But it was also an exciting meeting as we prepared for GA, and so I will now turn it over to Kathy Mulvey to talk to you about what we did with that part of the meeting.
Thanks a lot, Kathleen. So I'll highlight a few big pieces of progress that we made in the areas of socially responsible investing. And so first off, as folks may remember, our committees recommended and the UUA board approved back in January an increase in the allocation of our portfolio as a whole to community investing from 1% to 5%. So that's really exciting, and it represents really millions of dollars more that are going to go to low-income communities, which is a particularly acute need at this time that people are dealing with the combined crisis of the COVID-19 pandemic and the economic impact that's had disproportionately on low-income communities and communities of color. So we made two new community investments, and this is work that's led by one of our committee members, Vanessa Lowe, who's got a couple of decades of experience in this field. One of them is to the Capital Good Fund, and this is a $250,000 loan to be used toward equitable financial services. So essentially, this will provide essential capital for deployment of small dollar personal loans ranging from $300 to $25,000. And they're used really for a range of purposes, everything from immigration expenses to purchasing, refinancing, or repairing a vehicle to energy efficiency upgrades. And so this is one, and the fund actually launched COVID-19 crisis relief loans back in March. So we were really pleased to be able to infuse capital into that fund. The other is three investments actually in Self-Help Credit Union, which is a credit union with which we have a long-standing relationship. And there's a traditional self-help CD, which is supporting all of Self-Help's work to help low-wealth communities that have been underserved by larger financial institutions. There's also a women and children CD that we invested in. to support lending to women-headed households, women-owned businesses, and early childhood education, and then a community recovery CD. So that was created recently to support communities affected by COVID-19. So those were those three investments come to a total of $400,000. So we'll talk more later in this presentation about really looking to you and other UUs to help identify further opportunities to make community investments. The other area that we had some exciting progress was in shareholder advocacy, and that work under Andrew's guidance continues to be led by Tim Brennan as a special advisor on advocacy and engagement. So we were the lead filer on a resolution with ExxonMobil. Their annual meeting happened last week, and this resolution was calling for a report on political contributions and got more than 30% support, which is very high and a big step up from last year. So that was an important message to the management of ExxonMobil that investors want to see more disclosure of how the company spends money in the political realm. Similarly, with Abbott Labs, we filed a resolution on for a report on lobbying activities and expenditures. So this is an area of longstanding UU advocacy, and this resolution got 20%, which was three times what it got, a similar resolution got in 2014. So these issues around transparency in our democracy that we've long been champion for are gaining increased resonance as governance issues, really, with the leadership of public companies. The other really important area of work has been in response to the COVID-19 crisis, and we've worked with other faith and values-based investors, including through the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility. So we joined in a statement of more than 300 investors with more than $9 trillion in assets under management, calling on companies to protect their workers at this time by providing paid leave, prioritizing health and safety, maintaining employment, and keeping their supplier and customer relationships. And we also joined with other investors specifically in writing to companies in the meatpacking industry, calling for them to take steps to protect workers. So this is a real example about how we can use our investments to respond to issues that are emerging. And you know, I'm sure that as all of us deal around the country with anti-Black violence and the backlash of white supremacists, we'll also see investors and opportunities for us to step up as investors in responding to that as well. So I'll turn it back to Kathleen at this point.
I did have two slides that I was gonna highlight, and I probably should have done that before I turned it over to Kathy. So just briefly, in terms of our current market outlook, we put this slide in on page 10, slide 10, to remind you all of the four themes that we discussed with our consultant: virus trajectory, permanent interventions, China transitions, and the globalization backlash. What seems to be driving the market currently has taken the focus away from a broader global focus, and it's much more focused on what's going on within the US and the tremendous support that the central bank, particularly the Fed, is giving during this time of volatility. And that seems to have given the market quite a bit of confidence, and valuations have pushed higher, even though the background with the news is a very different picture. So it's something that we're cognizant of, that you've got a few short-term drivers that seem to be grabbing the market's attention, and values do not look as attractive to us. The other important thing that we discussed at the quarterly meeting was portfolio liquidity in the face of all of the market volatility. And so we also wanted to provide this slide here on slide 11, which gives you a sense of the amount of liquidity in the portfolio, which is very high, that all of the managers that we're investing with have strategies that we are able to adjust to if needed very easily. So over two-thirds available, or close to two-thirds, on a daily or weekly basis, and over a quarter that are accessible on a monthly basis. So plenty of liquidity as we go into a period of what is likely to be continued volatility. And yet we continue to stay disciplined, focus on asset allocation and rebalancing and taking opportunities when they come to us. But we are all very excited about the virtual GA that's coming up later this month. And we've been working hard to prepare some sessions that will be of interest, we hope, to many of you. Kathy, can I turn it over to you here to go through those?
Sure. Thanks, Kathleen. And yeah, we're seeing this year's GA as really an opportunity to showcase the real integration of our investment committee and our socially responsible investing committee in using our investments to advance UU values and really the work that we've done over the past couple of years to update our socially responsible investing guidelines, including to reflect the 2017 statement of conscience and the work that we can do through our investments to contribute to anti-racism and dismantling white supremacy culture. We're excited about a virtual GA and the opportunities to showcase this work through a workshop on mobilizing investments to advance UU values. And that's going to look overall at the integration of our committees that are pioneering work in the past and currently, and really provide you all with an opportunity to help us identify ways to make those community investments that are so needed now. And the portfolio value as of the end of April, it's a $9 million opportunity for us to have an impact with our investment dollars. Vanessa Lowe, who's our community investing leader on the Socially Responsible Investing Committee, will also be presenting in a stewardship workshop on money as medicine that is based on the work of Edgar Villanueva in his book, Decolonizing Wealth. So I encourage folks to participate in that as well. We will be highlighted at the virtual exhibit hall throughout GA, so our resources will be available to UUCEF investors and other congregations looking at what the UUCEF has to offer. And we'll have another opportunity for a webinar engagement on what's called the virtual learning stage on Saturday, the 27th. So that's a big day to have some back and forth with members of our committee. And then we are also really delighted to support a business resolution on embodying human rights in our investment decisions that has been sponsored by a range of UU social justice groups. And we worked in a collaborative way with them in developing the resolution and are looking forward to supporting its adoption during the plenary sessions. So I know that the schedule is still in development, but here's the link where you can find the schedule of events online. And you can also always reach out to all of us from our contact information being available on the Common Endowment Fund website. We look forward to seeing many of you again there. And I should say that both the virtual learning stage and the mobilizing investments workshop are will have opportunities for interaction through through the Zoom platform. So we can answer your questions and also have some breakout discussions in the workshop. And this is one of the recent investments that we actually did at our February meeting, which is one of the great stories that Vanessa Lowe will share as part of the presentation at GA. So with that, I think I'll turn it back over to, I don't know whether it goes to Kathleen or Andrew at this point.
Yeah, I can take it from here. And that last picture that Kathy had on screen, just one good story of what community investing means in practical terms. I put in the chat window, and I think those of you that are on your computers can see that. There was another article in the Saturday Wall Street Journal about the Capital Good Fund, actually one of the ones we just invested in after our May meeting. So as many of you may know, the Wall Street Journal does not make it easy to get at their articles, but if you know somebody with a login, or if you have one, or you just want to try to crack the code on Google and read all about it, you can see some of the good work that fund is doing down in Rhode Island. So I think the way this is going to work now is that everybody on the call can just unmute themselves if they would like to ask a question. I think maybe we'll just try to take turns asking questions, although if it gets a little out of hand, we may start up a queue for questions in the chat room. But I'll be quiet, and if anyone has a question from the audience, we'll answer it for you.
Hi.
Kathy Abernathy. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Hi. Scott Rubin from the Susquehanna Valley Congregation in Pennsylvania. I'm really interested in the work you continue to do on corporate resolutions. Actually, two things, corporate resolutions and also some of the community investments. And I'm wondering if it's possible to communicate the actions you're taking and recommending so that congregations that own individual securities, or communicate that with our members who might own individual securities, know what it is you're doing and how they should vote when they receive proxies. And with the community investing, a similar type of question, if those investments are open in smaller amounts than you're able to invest in, whether that can be communicated in, I guess, more real time to the congregation, so that we might want to put some of our own money to work, in the same investment.
Yeah, those are great questions. So we do work with an advisory firm to take our values and our instructions about our values and translate them into how we vote on resolutions with companies across the whole portfolio. And I believe that I know our voting record is available on the Common Endowment Fund website, although I think it's not, Susan may need to help me out with this, I think it's now more post the voting, but you could certainly see a lot of these resolutions come up again in 1 year after another when they qualify by meeting the threshold for reintroduction. So probably the easiest thing to say there is that if a congregation owns securities directly in a company and wants to know how the UUA is voting, I think if you contact Susan and Andrew, we can let you know what our vote is on various resolutions that are coming forward. And Susan has pasted something in there. Thank you, Susan. In terms of the community investing, great question. I put into the chat a blog that we've prepared that we posted recently that highlights the increased commitment to community investing. And you can also see a complete list of our community investments as the Common Endowment Fund as of the end of March. It's available as one of the links, and I'll paste that into the chat here as well. In addition, there's a great opportunity with the UUA's Community Development Match program, which matches investments in community development financial institutions up to $10,000. So if your congregation is making a community investment, by all means, and it's in a certified CDFI, by all means, take advantage of that opportunity. And I am seeing another question here. Any resources for congregations to create their own socially responsible investing policies? So I have two things to say there. One is you could certainly take inspiration from the updates to the socially responsible investing guidelines that were adopted. And I'll paste that document into the chat. And the other is come to our workshop, and we can have a breakout on that topic among the others that we're addressing at General Assembly, or look for us on the virtual learning stage. And that's also something that we can discuss more there. So I know that my home congregation is All Souls Unitarian in Washington, D.C., and we've actually sort of almost in parallel to the work that was done by the Common Endowment Fund, we've just updated our investment policy, and I'd be happy just one-on-one to share that experience as well, to whatever extent that's helpful.
Hi, Kathy Abernathy from the New River UU Fellowship in Beckley, West Virginia. I am a brand newbie on trying to follow this, and there was a lot the initial speaker said that I just don't understand. Do you have any kind of materials for understanding how to interpret the balance sheets and stuff you sent us?
I can jump in on that one, and then if Kathleen wants to add anything in also. I don't think we have anything written up that sort of defines what each of those lines on those reports mean, but I mean, essentially the way they're constructed is that, you know, we have what our investments are, and I think on those March reports there's probably 24 or so individual investments on there. Right below that there's a benchmark that investment is compared to. So I know there's a lot of data on there, but it's only the ones that have the mark, something in that first column, that market value column, that represent the positions that we actually own. And then of course there's all the various historical returns across that. The interesting, the ones that we've talked about on prior versions of this call that are interesting are these numbers right across the top on this page that Kathleen has up on the screen. And I'm just moving stuff around on my desktop to see it. So we have, you know, this composite return, the allocation index, and the policy index. So what the composite return is how we actually did. And we sometimes report that a couple different ways: gross, you know, the absolute return, and net, which is less the fees that we pay to some of the money managers and some of the costs that the endowment fund bears to support its administrative responsibilities. But then we compare that to these allocation and policy indices. The policy would just be, if we went exactly sort of what we said we were going to do and on like the midpoint of our targets across different investment classes. The allocation index reflects the fact that we have some parameters that we can move within on those different asset class allocations. So if we are, you know, overweight international equities in a time when that's doing really well, the allocation index will tend to outperform. And then the composite just sort of reflects security and money manager selection among the places we've actually chosen to invest. But yeah, I think it would make a lot of sense to write up a sort of a primer on how to interpret these reports. And I think that's probably something we can get out there in the so over the summer once GA is in the rearview mirror. Now, Kathleen, do you want to add anything on that? And if not, I know there's a couple of sort of questions that I don't know if you're seeing them in the chat that are, you know, better for you to answer.
I'll take a look at it. You know what? It's because I've still got the screen up and I didn't want to stop sharing. It's harder for me to see the chat box. But Andrew, I think you answered that really well. A primer would be helpful. there are folks out there who do like us to go into the detail, and we try to be cognizant of everybody's time and balance it between the investment information and the socially responsible investment information, and not get too much in the weeds. But you know, there are many folks who do want to learn more about that, and I will take a look at that. I do think that it's the top line and the long term, the 5, 7, and 10 year numbers overall that become important, and that's something that we are going to be talking about at the mobilizing investments with UU values at GA that will go into the asset allocation, what the expected returns are, and how we come up with that allocation. So hopefully, if you're there, we can answer that or through some follow-up detail. Andrew, would you mind reading the questions that you see for me?
The two that are at the top of the queue that you're going to be best to weigh in on. Someone is Dave Carlson is just asking for a comment on China, which, you know, before the coronavirus was something we were definitely paying a lot of attention to. And then Margie, if I'm pronouncing it right, had a quick question on our allocation, sort of equities versus fixed income, and where that is and how we view that, but just sort of a real basic answer on that one.
Sure. Well, I mean, China is the big conundrum, I think. And the reason why we showed that slide with the four themes is that all four of those areas are, we believe, going to be very important for the market, including China and what happens with the globalization backlash, and we're seeing that in populism. And that clearly should be impacting the markets right now. But right now, the markets seem to only be caring about the fact that the Fed is keeping interest rates low, and everyone is focused on when the US economy is going to come out of this very challenging environment that appears short term, but is definitely impacting many industries and companies. So China, I think, is not a market focus, but it's something that is keeping us cautious on following through with our rebalancing in one fell swoop, because clearly the tensions are high and that is going to impact the market, and we're not seeing that being priced in right now. So it's not that we're not thinking about China. I think China as a rising superpower has been something we've been focused on, but now it's going to be more about, I think, the tensions that are growing between the West and China in particular. So we haven't lost, we're not taking our eye off the ball there, but the market clearly has, and that's reflected in values. And then regarding the mix between equity and fixed. So a standard portfolio, I would think of as having a 60% equity allocation and 40% fixed income. Endowment funds, because they are focused on a much longer time horizon, although do need to be generating sufficient returns to meet spending policy, which we are currently doing, although it's challenging with low expected returns. That 60-40 has worked well over the last three decades. The typical endowment fund does tend to have more in equity and less in fixed income. And one of the ways that other funds have approached this, and we've done that in a small step, is by incorporating private markets or other areas into our asset allocation. Now, one of the things that we're excited about, as Kathy and Andrew have mentioned, is the community investment, which falls into our asset allocation. And you do see that on slide 7. It was at 1%. We plan to bring that up to 5%, and potentially over time, private markets from 5 to 10, since equity and fixed income are expected to have fairly low expected returns. So our current composition is roughly 60% equities, 20% fixed income, and 20% other areas. And that gives us diversification, areas that are less correlated, and with that other area, a way to offset the lower returns that are expected over the next 10 years. So that's a simple answer for that one. Do we have other questions?
Yeah, Dave Carlson, Orange Coast Unitarian in Costa Mesa, California. I have more a comment. Friday morning, I meet with a group of 25 senior investment and financial managers. The signal on China is extremely bearish. There's a prediction of the failure of the economy, and the result is the bellicose positioning is a way of being able to blame the U.S. and India for the problems in the economy. Another example is their recent actions on Hong Kong take the issues away from the domestic issues and put them into the international. This group is very bearish on China and very bearish on companies whose value propositions depend on Chinese supply chains, of which there are many. But just a note of caution on all things related to China. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. And yes, I think I'm saying the same thing in terms of while those the China and the globalization backlash are grayed out, it doesn't mean we aren't considering them real and they are shifting. It's just that is definitely not priced into the market, but I would agree those are very real concerns and companies are adjusting to the fact that the supply chains are changing. Thank you for sharing that.
All right, Kathleen, we have a couple other ones in the chat. I can answer the first and then maybe you would be best for the second. So John had asked a little while ago if we'd done any analysis around the increase in the community investment allocation and what that might do to the aggregate return of the common endowment fund. And I guess what I'd say to that, John, is a couple of things. One is as part of that increased allocation, the board also stipulated that half of it needed to be invested in market rate of return investments. Some of these community investments definitely have more of a, you know, I don't want to say a charitable aspect to them, but you may be giving up a little bit of yield in an effort to do some good work in the world. But we don't put all of our eggs in that basket. I think in a vacuum, if you said, well, I'm moving money from equities to community investment, you're probably over the long run giving up some yield. But the important thing to remember with community investments is they're not really correlated to anything else that we own. So when you look at it from a portfolio standpoint, you're greatly reducing risk just because of those reduced correlations. So the committee was confident that this increased allocation was not going to have a noticeably kind of adverse effect on the aggregate return. So I hope that helps. Kathleen Bruce had asked in the chat if you had any advice for congregations who might be counting on endowment fund income to fund projects over the next few years. And I think that maybe this gets into the conversation around expected rate of return on the endowment.
Definitely. And that, so the way we think about it, and this is actually a slide we've got for the workshop. In the long term, currently, fixed income is likely to earn 2% and equities 6%. You've got to take that with a grain of salt because those numbers will change as the market changes. And the market keeps going up and valuations are not all that attractive. So in a less attractive market environment, with rich valuations, it's tougher to get great returns. If we do see volatility ahead, that will increase returns. But right now, it is tough. But what we aim to generate is a combination of what is the typical draw, the UUA and most congregations on average take roughly 4.5%. So we target 4.5% plus a rate of inflation that we want to keep pace with, which is currently just under 2%. And that gets us to a target, again, long-term target of 6.2%, meaning there are going to be years when we do much better than that and years where we might underperform. But as long as we stick to that asset allocation, we should be able to achieve that long-term return, which you do see here at 10 years. Now, again, this is gross, a 6.3% return, and inception, which is, I believe, just beyond 15 years, is 6.7%. So it is getting tougher to achieve that, and you do have to look at if we spend more than 4.5%, what does that do to the endowment? But over the long run and a full market cycle, we're in line with being able to achieve that. Now, we are in a very unprecedented time, and one of the reasons why we put up the liquidity profile was to let everyone know that, sure, if spending needs are higher, we're not going to change our risk profile just to achieve shorter term higher returns. That would take the logic out of our philosophy, but there's plenty of liquidity within so that if draws are above average for a period of time, we can achieve that without altering our strategy very much. So we're in good shape, and again, it's the discipline, the ability to rebalance, and being dynamic when the market gives us those opportunities that allow us as a fund of significant size to help your congregations achieve their missions and sustain their operations.
All right, I'm just going to take a minute here to see if there's anybody that's dialed in who maybe can't ask a question in the chat that wants to get in with a question for the presenters. Okay, doesn't sound like it. Kathleen, there's one other one in the chat asking for sort of what we mean by permanent interventions.
Ah, sometimes I ask that. I've asked the same question. Because they're only permanent as long as everyone believes they're permanent. Yes, that it is a little bit difficult to interpret that, but essentially it's that the central banks with a low interest rate policy are keeping the markets going. They're providing sufficient liquidity in the market that the markets are not stumbling too much. When we saw the decline in February, the Fed stepped up, as are most of the central banks around the world. That can only go on for so long. In the short term and the medium term, it means that government deficits are going to continue to rise. And that eventually will be problematic for the fixed income markets. So one of the reasons why fixed income is expected to return only 2% is that growth has got to come from some area. Right now, the only source of that is coming from the central banks and keeping interest rates low. And they've said that they intend to keep them low as long as necessary. Although when you also read some of the speeches from the Fed presidents and Chairman Powell, they are concerned about moral hazard, and they will, if the economy is on sound footing, once a vaccine has been found and we return to a new, different way of life, you could see some continued volatility in the markets. And that's, again, why we're very comfortable with our current asset allocation, rebalancing gradually and watching the markets for much better opportunities, which aren't present today.
And that is a good segue to the next question that we have, which is sort of an observation that our international equity allocation might be relatively large. And I know that it is compared to peer. So I don't know if you want to talk about that also, Kathleen.
So in looking at the long-term expected returns, and this is mainly based on looking at history, and so again, with a grain of salt, and current valuations. International has lower valuations, both EM and international. And the diversification away from the US market, since we're not taking as much risk in private markets, we may need to mute everybody.
Yeah. Did you want
to? I'll do that. I'm not saying who's unmuted, but let me do that.
Oh, yeah. I agree. Tomorrow.
All right.
Except for me.
Okay. Yeah.
So, because we don't have, we have the allocation to private markets, and it's much lower than our endowment peers, in order to achieve our target return. Our consultant and we are in agreement with them that overweighting on a global basis, and if you look at the composition, that international is, so policy is 21% international compared to 32% for US. That is slightly higher than the typical endowment, but those valuations are more attractive. International again is at 21 and EM is at just under 10. So EM I think of as the higher risk category in international, and we have low exposure there. We have enough that it's going to correlate differently. And then on the international side, it's a good balance to the U.S. large cap equity, which has much higher valuations. And because the managers that we've hired, MFS, Boston Common, Baxter Street and Sevian are more opportunistic, but MFS and Boston as our lead international equity managers, when you look at the returns that they've provided. MFS was down 5.4%, so close to what was going on in large cap, and beating their benchmark by almost 700 basis points. So they're active, they're focused on the right companies. And Boston Common, similarly, was down almost 6%, but about 600 basis points better than the IFA. So even though we have broad exposure, it's with active managers who are doing an excellent job at their security selection. Our newest manager to the roster here is Ownership Capital. We just funded them, as I mentioned, May 1. They are all cap and really a global manager, and they also are concentrated but focused on making an impact. They're entirely impact focused. And while they have been overweighted in the US, they can go really anywhere, they are seeing more opportunities that appear to be opening up on the global landscape. So that's why we're holding some of that allocation to later this year, expecting that they might see even better opportunities that might be quite different from where we are today. So those are the levers that we can pull to be disciplined with that rebalancing. But I think what the strength, even as busy as these several pages are, is that we've put in place a very diversified, strong roster of experienced managers, getting access to institutional product that you may not be able to get to on the individual congregation level. So it is busy, and I did hear that we need to be able to explain that better. So I've got my marching orders and know what I'll be working on, because it is valuable information and easier to understand as you get familiar with these pages. So we will try to do that for you.
All right, thank you, Kathleen. There was one other question in there, and I don't know that we have the answer at our fingertips, just asking how much of our international allocation is to Chinese equities. I do know that China actually will map to emerging markets, not to international. But you know, the reality is there's exposure to China kind of throughout the equity portfolio, just because so many corporations either have supply chains that go through there or customers there, that just looking at where the corporations are domiciled maybe doesn't really give the right picture on that. But that's an interesting question that we can try to get the answer to before the next time we're all together.
Yeah, it and I'm sure that will be a question that comes up now even more and more with the rising tensions. My recollection from some of the manager meetings that we've sat in on is it's not very high, but that's not a firm answer. So I agree, a good question, and one that we can follow up on and continue to provide information on country breakdowns around the globe. Because we do see this as an important source of return, but knowing where that is within both the international and emerging market buckets is important to our investors, and that's clear.
All right, great. So that's all the questions I'm seeing in the chat. Give anybody that wants to ask one verbally, maybe one last chance. And if not, I just wanted to thank everybody for attending today. And thank you, Susan, for setting us up on Zoom. I thought this worked really well. Seeing the slides and be able to talk about them together, it's much easier than everybody printing them out themselves and trying to follow along. So I'm glad we made this change. It was good to see so many of your faces today, and hopefully see you in what, about 3.5 weeks at some of our GA sessions. So that's it for today, and we'll see you in another 3 months. Thanks so much.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.